will switch back to old technology. The subject of my talk is neutrinoless double beta decay in theories beyond the standard model. And I should mention that this is an old problem. It was proposed in 1939 by Fourier as a way to distinguish whether the neutrinos are massive Majorana particles. It was soon after I was born, and after so many years, the problem is still outstanding. And as far as I can tell, it's only superconductivity that took so long. I infer that this is a very hard problem, and yet a very important problem, and that's why it persists for so many years. Since the previous speakers were very kind, and they talk extensively about the light neutrino mass, I reshuffled my transparencies during the intermission, and so I can talk about some aspects of neutrinoless double beta decay other than the now fashionable and perhaps most important, which is the neutrino mass. Let's have a look at history, as I mentioned. There are many nuclear systems where usual beta decay is forbidden, so they're absolutely stable, but the nuclei, which are 2 units of charge away, are accessible. And here I have the standard process, the 2-electron emission. But of course, we have sister reactions, which for experimental reasons are not so much pursued these days, but perhaps in the future they might also be important. This is an exotic process because it violates the lepton number. And also, if observed, it will demonstrate that the neutrinos are massive Majorana particles. Even from the very old times, it was written down that the inverse lifetime is essentially the product of 3 factors. The first factor, G, is kinematics and gross properties of the nucleus. Then here is the nuclear matrix element. But what they did not know in the past is what we really adore today, which is the lepton violating parameter. And for example, in the standard theory, this is the average neutrino mass expressed in units of the electron mass. Practically every theory beyond the standard model gives rise to Majorana neutrinos, and therefore it leads to neutrinoless double beta decay. And conversely, neutrinoless double beta decay can constrain these models. Grad unified theories, supersymmetric models, superstring inspired models, or recently brain world theories, all of them predict that neutrinoless double beta decay must occur at some level. And as I said, the most important is light Majorana neutrinos. And as we shall see, this leads to a long-range operator, which is perhaps better understood than anything else. But they often offer additional lepton-violating mechanisms, which involve the exchange of heavy particles, heavy neutrinos, Higgs particles, Suzy particles, and so on. These may or may not dominate in neutrinoless double beta decay, but the nuclear physics, because they're short-range operators, is a little bit more complicated. Pictorially, then, one would like, the first diagram is the usual neutrino mass mechanism. It involves a light neutrino. In principle, you could have diagram B, which involves light neutrinos, but it is independent of the mass. And it can mean, for example, in supersymmetry, or when you have right and left-handed currents together. And the final one, of course, now it is very short-range operator, which can occur, for example, in R-parity-violating supersymmetry. Of course, these additional mechanisms should not disturb you, because there is a very old theorem due to Schechter and Valle that shows if you take the legs of neutrinoless double beta decay, the up-down quarks and the electrons, as you join them by W bosons, you transform them into internal lines. So the only external lines now are the neutrinos. And effectively, you get a Majorana mass term. So if neutrino is double beta decay is observed, regardless of which mechanism dominates the process, it is demonstrated that the neutrinos are massive Majorana particles. Now, specializing a little farther, I want to talk about nuclear matrix elements in terms of nuclear models, because we have a specialized talk tomorrow. But I should mention something which are not so much emphasized. As I mentioned, if the intermediate particle is light neutrinos, we have a long-range operator. This is very much well understood. However, you have to worry how you go from the quark to the nucleon level. And when you do this, of course, in addition to V minus A, you can also have pseudoscalar current, which is, of course, is related via PCAEC to the axial current. And therefore, because the intermediate momentum, the neutrino is an intermediate particle, is about 85 MeV or so, then these things affect the nuclear matrix element. And for the light neutrino, it depends on the nucleus, but crudely speaking, is about 30%. So every nuclear matrix element you've seen is decreased by 30%, which means all the limits that you've seen in the literature, regardless of who calculated them, must be increased by an equivalent amount. Then for the short-range operators, of course, because you have the nuclear hard core, the nucleons cannot go so close. Just zero, actually, if you have very heavy particles with a almost small range. However, we know that the nucleons are not point-like particles. We know they have a form factor and so on. And therefore, no matter how heavy your particle is, in the two-nucleon model, essentially the range operator is determined by the proton mass, which is still short range, but not very short range. It is reasonably stable. On the other hand, if you have a short range operator, other particles in the nucleus could contribute. For example, you could have pions in flight between two nucleons that could do the double beta decay themselves rather than nucleons. And this has been very important in recent years because it has been found to dominate in the case of supersymmetric models where you have scalar and pseudoscalar interactions. As I mentioned before, here is what happens in the light neutrino case. What is white is the matrix element without introducing these pseudoscalar corrections, and the black one represents after the correction. As I said before, crudely speaking, is 30% for all nuclear systems and for all nuclear models. To explain a little bit what I meant by pions in flight, for example, the nucleons don't see the double beta decay, only the pions do, and the nucleons communicate among themselves via this pion exchange. I won't talk about nuclear physics. I'll also skip things about the mixing matrix and so on, and the information coming essentially from neutrino oscillations. But as it was mentioned in the previous talk, neutrino oscillations cannot tell you whether the neutrinos are Majorana or Dirac particles. Also, it cannot set the scale. And therefore, based on neutrino oscillations, we cannot decide, for example, whether we have the normal hierarchy on the left, where the lowest state is essentially an electronic neutrino with admixtures of mu and tau, or whether you have the inverted hierarchy, where the electronic neutrino is essentially in the upper level. All you know is delta M23 square and delta M12 square. You don't know where to put the scale and which of the two actually is the truth. Now, if you put in the information you've got from oscillations into the double beta decay, you can get some useful information. And let me write down a simple diagram. It's written at the nucleon level. And of course, concentrate only on the light. the intermediate neutrino because of the helicity, you pick out the mass. What I write U11 here is the usual mixing matrix involving the light neutrinos discussed by the previous speakers. And you have, of course, the Majorana phase coming in, which would make the matrix element vanish if the neutrinos are Dirac particles. And in the 3x3 model, you have two such independent phases. Let us say you know from neutrino oscillations what this mixing matrix is. You don't know, of course, the phases. And you don't also know one of the angles, let's say θ13. And therefore, if you put in the information you get from neutrino oscillations, get something you've seen before. This one is taken from the work of Bilenki, Simkovits, and Fessler. And we have the average mass coming from double beta decay on the left versus the lightest neutrino. And this is M1 in the upper case, and it's M3 in the lower case. And of course, with the continuous line, it's the best fit. And the dotted line, it's the 3 sigma level. And I have, of course, colored in red the allowed region. And of course, you see also the experiments. The best, let's say, limit right now, the Heidelberg-Moskow, is really high up there. Is there a pointer? It's high up there, and you see if the normal hierarchy is the case, then even the best experiments like the genius will not come into this interesting region over here. And you also notice that there is no lower limit on the mass coming from double beta decay. It could even be zero. You are a little bit luckier, more lucky in the case where the lightest neutrino is M3. Now, Heidelberg-Moskow is here, and presumably the future experiments, Moon begins, and certainly genius will be in the physically interesting region. And you notice here, of course, that we have a lower bound. And here is the 3 sigma level. And of course, as you go from here to almost degenerate, the situation improves a little bit. So neutrino double beta decay is favored if the degenerate model actually is the one that is the truth. And of course, these gentlemen were very kind to the experimentalists. So rather than drawing a diagram with a neutrino mass, they convert it into a lifetime. And you see, of course, in this case again, genius does not hit the interesting area over here, unless, of course, if the lightest neutrino is quite heavy. But in the inverted hierarchy, hopefully will be right here. And then it will be a triumph for neutrinoless double beta decay. Okay, now the minute, of course, you consider other than light neutrinos, as I mentioned before, you could have now additional contribution coming from the heavy neutrino guy. In left-handed theories, the coupling here is the coupling between the light and the heavy sector, which is really very small. For example, in grand unified theories, it's going to be the mass of the up quarks divided by the heavy Majorana neutrino. Again, you have now a lepton-violating parameter. It's now inversely proportional to the mass of the neutrino, because here the mass in the denominator of this propagator dominates. You have this, which is now a very small mixing, so the smallness now comes both from here and from there. Again, you have Majorana phases. On the other hand, if in addition, not only you have the right-handed neutrino, but it also participates in weak interactions, then you could have an interference between a left current and a right current here. Then the helicity is such that you pick out the momentum rather than the mass. For a light neutrino, this is the only interesting case now. And therefore, you get a leptin-violated parameter, which is called lambda or average lambda here, which is independent of the mass. And if the hadronic currents here are the same chirality as the leptonic currents, but if they are of the same chirality, then you get another leptin-violating parameter, which is eta. And those now are related as follows. Eta is essentially epsilon times this, and epsilon is tangent zeta. Zeta is the Gauge boson mixing angle, so this comes via the mixing of the Gauge bosons. And the parameter lambda is proportional to kappa, which is the ratio of the two Gauge boson masses indicated here. And then, of course, again, you have this that comes in from the neutrino physics. So even though you have right-handed currents, you cannot extract information about the right-handed boson alone, because still the neutrino properties come in. And now you have this, which is large. This is what we've been discussing all along here about the neutrino mass matrix. But we have, of course, this small, which comes, as I said, from the mixing between the light and the heavy neutrino sector. Of course, this is very interesting because the kinematics of this is very different, because it involves the average, it involves the intermediate momentum rather than the energy. And as we shall see, this has some implications on double beta decay. Now, on the average, you would say modulo nuclear physics that we'll discuss before, and we'll discuss tomorrow, I'm sorry, and the lifetime measurements, which we'll hear tomorrow, you get an effective neutrino mass, which is in this range. And here I have taken into account the corrections of 30% that I mentioned. And the best, of course, comes from germanium 76. You get also a limit for the parameter lambda, which is of the order of 10 to the minus 6 indicated here. The parameter eta, because the nuclear matrix element is larger, is quite a bit smaller. It's 10 to the minus 8. I won't discuss the Majorum coupling, which is indicated by G. Of course, you have interference in the lifetime. And that's going to be a big problem in the analysis of neutrinos double beta decay once we have a definite answer. And that's why I insist that quite a number of experiments are pursued, because the three signatures is the sum of the electron energies is one. All experiments perhaps will do this. But then you must make sure that the electrons come from the same point, like a NEMO, for example, experiment, which will be discussed tomorrow, and perhaps if the electrons are produced simultaneously. So in principle, we would like to have all these different experiments. Anyway, you have interference. And on this axis, I have the neutrino mass, and on this axis, I have lambda. Of course, it doesn't deviate from a circle very much, this ellipsoid, but you could see that in principle, in some nuclear systems, the maximum could actually be higher than what you get by considering one mechanism alone, as we do. And the same thing applies also here. You could see, for example, the case of the eta super more open, more obvious. The maximum is a little above of what you get here if you take one mechanism at a time. So the interference pattern is going to be important. Now, if you have the right-handed neutrino alone, of course, you get a mass term, as usual. But now the right-handed bosons come in. These are much heavier. These are of order one, because this involves the heavy Majorana neutrinos. So this matrix is approximately unitary. But the W-gauge bosons are heavier, so you get a suppression coming essentially from kappa, which is kappa squared. And of course, the neutrino mass comes here in the denominator. So you have this term from the mass. It could be mixing between the Gauge bosons. So you get a term which is proportional to epsilon squared, which is this mixing here. Or you could have an interference term where you have the heavy mass here and you have mixing here. So the information you get then out of double beta decay is this expression. That's one of the problems in double beta decay. You cannot separate only one parameter. So we have the combination of these times, of course, the neutrino properties. So if you want to use this information, suppose it is available, then all you can get is this combination. This Gauge boson properties versus the heavy Majorana neutrino mass, which is a straight line. You cannot say anything about these individual couplings themselves. However, if you combine this with the parameters lambda and eta I discussed before, because the ratio of kappa over epsilon is the same as lambda over eta, presumably we have some limits for those, and combine this with this, then in principle you can determine epsilon as a function of the neutrino mass and the heavy Gauge boson mass as a function of the neutrino mass. Now, if you take a limit which is essentially from super allowed decay of what epsilon is, then you get this between this and this, and therefore this now presumably is in this region. On the other hand, if you take the limit that you find in particle data group, then you see that you must be above that, and therefore it means that this heavy neutrino mass must be smaller than something like 0.1 times 10 to the 6, should be 10 to the 5 GeV. So therefore, the combination of all these could give you useful information. Anyway, the other important aspect in recent years, and I'm told I have a few minutes, is if you consider R parity violating supersymmetry now, so you could have lepton violation, for example, coming from supersymmetry. This is a D quark becoming a U quark. It produces an S electron, and the same thing here. And of course, when you have the S electron, then this with the neutralino could lead to double beta decay very easily. It could be here a gluino, and so on. All these are very many diagrams. It's a coherent effect. And presumably, you can get a lepton violating parameter coming out of supersymmetry. And I'll show you an analysis here. And as I mentioned, 2-pion mode tends to dominate versus only nucleons. This you extract from experiment. And then based on some analysis in SUSY models, you get a limit on this R parity violating parameter lambda prime involving only the first generation of the order of 10 to the minus 3. And of course, if only nucleons were there, it's about 3 times bigger. In any case, you can see you can get useful information from neutrinoless double beta decay regarding R parity violating supersymmetry. The only problem again is it depends on the scale. And of course, we do the usual treatment, the allowed parameter space of supersymmetry and so on, and therefore, in the limits I gave you before, we took this scale to be 100 over here, but if, of course, if this increases, then the limit becomes not so good. In fact, it becomes comparable with some limits that you get in the accelerator experiments. Now, I should come to the end. We'll hear tomorrow that the experimentalists are struggling very hard. They are going to improve their limits by an order of magnitude or two orders of magnitude within the next years. And therefore, if this is all done, then of course we might be able to tell whether, after all, neutrino is a Majorana particle after so many years and set the scale of the neutrino masses, combined, of course, with the usual decay experiments like the ones we heard before. Then for heavy neutrinos, again, their mass scale and their interactions, and whether we have right-handed bosons, how massive they are. We saw that we can get some parameters of supersymmetry, like the R-parity violating couplings. And, of course, whether we have light sterile neutrinos. I did not discuss this, but this is quite important because then the effective mass you get out of the double beta decay experiment will depend on the nucleus. The effective mass you get out, if we have neutrinos which are of the order of a few MeV, then nuclear physics and particle physics do not separate out. And therefore, the average neutrino mass you find is going to depend on the nucleus, and one should be prepared for this. And of course, you cannot do any of those things if the nuclear matrix elements are not reliably calculated. We will hear about this tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Jose?
Yeah, I would like to I hope you are a little bit more careful in quoting sensitivities, because some of the sensitivities for different experiments you had in that slide, as far as I can tell, are sort of
exaggerated,
arbitrary. Or
well, you see, the sensitivities, of course, depend on what kind of nuclear matrix elements you assume.
No, how much high you assume you have, and what
yes.
Kind of background you assume you have. So, you know, these are random numbers.
Well, of course, this is an experimental question, but I feel guilty because 20 years ago I discouraged Madame Wu because I calculated some nuclear matrix elements in calcium 48. And I found them to be very small in the simple model. So Madame Wu did not do the second generation of experiment because of me. So I don't want at this point to discourage the experimentalists. Maybe they are over ambitious. Maybe they exaggerate a little bit. But that's life. I will let them go ahead.
Okay, as a question.
You discussed many processes in addition to light, you know, light neutron exchange. I wonder, angular correlations of individual beta rates or energy correlations or some other experiment can differentiate the mechanisms involved?
This is a very good question. And I think, as I said, once neutrinos double beta decay is seen, a whole marathon will start again to have a definite analysis to see what's happening. As far as I can tell, the only difference is between the mass term and the parameters who are independent of the mass, which are kinematically different. Once you have this kinematical difference, then you have a different prediction, different energy dependence going from one nucleus to the other, which is very important. And also, if you observe the angular correlation, the coefficient, again, will depend on the energy. I mean, and therefore, as far as I can tell, it may be easy to see whether you have lambda or eta versus the mass, but it will be extremely difficult to separate the light neutrino from the heavy neutrino. Unless you have such progress in nuclear physics that by taking ratios, for example, of the excited state versus the ground state transition, if you compare one nucleus with another nucleus and so on. But by and large, I think to separate supersymmetry from the heavy neutrino and the light neutrino is going to be extremely difficult.
Okay, Hans.
I understand that you tried to give a review talk, but and so you contained many things which are more than 10 years old, but maybe it would have been good to give some references. The second point is, I'm not sure whether you read physics letters, otherwise you would have known that there is, at least to say it carefully, some indication for neutrinos double beta decay now.
Okay, actually it is unfortunate that I preceded the experimentalists, okay? Tomorrow are the experimental talks, and I want to keep the people's interest till tomorrow. So I think somehow it's a little unusual that I am in a different session than most of the experimental talks tomorrow. But anyway, I'm anxious to see, and perhaps I can add some comments tomorrow.
Okay, last question. Over there.
For the right-handed analysis and the fact of the behavior of angular distribution, you said, can you have also the same special angular distribution, but in the two neutrino process, the normal one?
Well, the two neutrino, of course, will have a different energy dependence, and the angular distribution can be distinguished. I think if in an experiment like NEMO, you could tell the two neutrino from the zero neutrino. But I guess the essence of the question was whether, if you restrict yourself to the neutrinoless mode, whether you can differentiate between the various mechanisms that I discussed. I didn't discuss the two neutrino mechanism at all.
Okay, thank you very much again. The session is over.